Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. You have me, your host. I'm Lindsay Roundtree, Head of Content and Exchange Wire, and I'm joined by our CEO, Kieran O'Kane. Hello.
Hello, Lindsay.
How are you?
I'm fine. Got a bit of a cold, though.
Oh, that's a shame. I'm sorry. Lovely. Sorry, guys, if you have to hear a lot of that during this week's episode. Yeah. And our special guest today is Will King. Will is Commercial Director at the Media Trust. Hello, Will.
Good morning.
How are you?
Super.
Excellent. Today, our topics are broadly focused around one big entity.
Break them up.
If you hadn't guessed from that comment what the entity is, we're talking about Google. So I'll tell you what the three topics are immediately, actually, because they're probably all merge into one another as we carry on. The first one is Google's massive announcement that it's going into gaming with the launch of Stadia. I'm going with Stadia. We'll see what they actually want to call it. Then, of course, that Google has been fined by the EU, 1.49 billion euros. And then a conversation following on from what we talked about with Gerhard Loef, which is about breaking up big tech and the potential argument that you could actually say big tech should be kept together. So let's kick off with Google's launch into gaming. I was chatting with our editor for our sister publication, The Gaming Economy, Will Freeman. He is a gaming guru. And he was saying that this launch, this news, which was announced at the Gaming Developers Conference in San Francisco this week, is one of the big four stories to ever happen in the history of gaming. And that includes the launch of the mobile phone, the launch of the PlayStation, and the news that Microsoft was going into gaming. That's how big this news at Google launching this platform is. It's being tipped as the Netflix of gaming, and it could hold massive implications for gaming in general, for the advertising industry. There's a lot of questions around what it will look like, but given the assets that Google currently has and the tech platforms it currently has, where does Stadia fit in? Lots of questions here. Don't know what the answers are yet. I don't think Google are able to help us yet, but generally I'd love to know your thoughts on what Google going into gaming in this realm actually means.
Yeah, there's a big question and a lot of sub questions. And I think if you look at the reporting of what's actually happened so far, clearly the timing is coinciding with a big industry event. And then behind the broad kind of headline announcement, there's not an enormous amount of detail in terms of, well, outside of the basic tech, there's nothing around distribution, there's nothing around monetization, all of those kinds of questions. If you look at the headlines, though, I suppose this is Google entering a $140 billion market where it currently really
growing.
Where it currently only nibbles around the edge in terms of the impact that we have seen Google have on markets that they enter. We've got to expect it to be significant.
Yeah. And when we refer to Google nibbling around the edge, we're referring, of course, to the fact that they got many sort of free-to-play games in the App Store,
the Android,
Google Play Store, but also the fact that YouTube is a massive source for gaming and for influencers, a kind of Twitch-style influencers, to be able to publish videos and kind of monetize their own content that way. So that could be an area that Google looks to get into with Stadia.
I saw someone comment this morning, actually, that they saw Stadia as not the future of gaming, but the future of YouTube.
Interesting. Which is an interesting thought.
It's just the genius of Google to join the dots, basically, isn't it? They've got all the requisite platforms here. And think about gaming right now, right? It's very much based around very expensive hardware, and it probably discourages a lot of people from playing, right? So imagine if you have the ability to flick on YouTube and basically hit a game straight off the bat on your TV using their controller. How many more people would that bring in? Like, particularly casual gamers. Like, I'm talking about the Candy Crush generation, who may be more motivated to do this. And then Google have just basically created the next big advertising revenue stream for them, right? A lot of this stuff might be ad-funded as well as Netflix style sort of subscription model. I just think it's absolute genius. They're a company just cannot be stopped. It's just they're like unstoppable. And it depresses me that a little bit, because it's when I look at it objectively, I just think it's such a great strategy, so smart, using all the best parts of what you have. So obviously they've tried to gatecrash the gaming community with the casual gaming, and they've got the Google platform. But obviously, gaming's going so strong, and it's such a digital-first environment that they feel they should be all over this. This is their territory, right? So this is a good way to kind of almost disrupt the industry. And I know there's been attempts by Nvidia, is that right? And a few others to kind of have their own. But Google just has that absolute scale to make it work.
And it's obviously it's a cloud platform, which means
which they've invested a lot of money.
They've invested
in
a lot of money, and there's a lot of tech going into this.
And they have all
those
data
centers
as well across the globe, which means that they can probably they're probably maybe one or two companies in the world that could actually do this at scale.
Yeah, they are not the first.
Amazon, Facebook, and Google.
Yeah,
are probably
they are
three.
Not the first cloud gaming platform to exist.
Yeah,
but they might be one of the few that will actually make it successful because of their clout.
I'm really surprised Apple haven't done this, given they've gone into TV, which I think is probably the stupidest decision. Stupidest strategy I've ever seen in my life.
They've had a little go, didn't they? I mean, didn't the latest Apple TV units have sort of semi remote control ish, sort of gamer control ish functionality, trying to build out a game proposition from App Store in the living room?
Do you guys think that this is a wider sort of inability from the industry to understand how important gaming is? You know what I mean? That Apple have gone for TV, right? And TV is such a congested channel right now. OTT especially. AT&T's got their own sort of streaming channel. You've got Roku, who've got that sort of like operating system. You've got every single Tom, Dick and Harry, like ITV and BBC are on about building their own. It's a very congested space. And yet gaming, particularly the streaming piece, is completely wide open. Hence the reason why Google gone into it. And you think with Google or with Apple, with their really, really strong platform play, right, and the ability to download casual gaming, it would be an easy route for them. But I feel that kind of, I wouldn't call it ignorance, but that kind of sort of antipathy towards gaming extends into brands as well, particularly when we're talking about advertising and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
I just think that gaming gets an awful bad rap.
But I think another company that has taken gaming very, very seriously is Facebook.
It's a distribution platform.
Yeah,
well, our friend Damien Burns is over there heading up the gaming department.
Quite.
Like so.
But if you think about gaming, is still under the radar for many, many people. I mean, it's ridiculous that some people still think of a gamer as someone with that hasn't washed their hair in 3 weeks and sits in their basement playing games all day long, because that's not what a game looks like anymore.
Really?
Frankly, you've got the casual free-to-play games like Candy Crush, and you've got the kind of the kind of cross-console games like Fortnite that are just taking the entire world by storm. And then you have the more hardcore gaming side of things.
Yeah.
But as a gaming industry, it's absolutely massive. But when we talk about connected TV, which is way behind where it should be, really, it's taken a long time to get to where everyone's talking about connected TV and understanding what it is. Actually, what Stadia will do is bring connected gaming into the industry. If you think about Fortnite, the fact that it can be played as a platform game, it can be played on your mobile device, it can be played anywhere you want, that is what the future of gaming is. And that is what Google will be able to deliver.
It's the next Netflixation of gaming.
I pull out another cliche. I mean, I look at the Spotification, another one. If you look at the way that Spotify, I mean, you mentioned disruption, Kieran. If you think, I mean, obviously we're lacking details on a bunch of stuff, but if you take what we know about this project and sort of put it somewhere in the future, and you map that alongside the way that Spotify and those music platforms fundamentally disrupted the music industry that had already been disrupted by a light touch digitization, right? So you have this industry that's dominated by labels and distribution and licensing and retail, and that's the way that your revenue is managed. And then you put that online, and that kind of shrinks a little bit in terms of like unit price, but grows in terms of scale. And then you put Spotify in, and Spotify fundamentally disrupts the whole of that value chain. It disrupts the hardware that you buy. You know, who buys CD players? Who buys anything except a connected device or listens on their phone?
Yeah.
Right? And everyone loves Spotify because they should. It's a great product from a user experience. It's incredible. But the effect on that industry is wholesale. It's not just the economics of the way that consumers behave. It's the hardware that they buy. It's the way that artists are remunerated. I mean, you could make a case that says Spotify has driven the live music marketplace,
which is
like nothing else, because that's where the acts go to make their money, right?
Yeah.
They've driven a renewed live music scene, merchandisation of bands, the t-shirts.
But they've taken the money out of the non-live music industry.
But you could argue that Spotify sort of empowered artists in a way as well, right? Because the money that was being paid for music has been decreasing all the time. So there's no money in actually selling records, right?
No.
But what Spotify can do is, and I think that their model's interesting, because like, who's going to sign a record deal in the future, right? Because, you know,
record deals were there for... It's D2C from bands, right?
Exactly. They were there. The record companies were there for distribution, right? They don't need that distribution anymore, right? Because Spotify just does that, right? So the ability for Spotify to say, guess what, Kieran, your band's got a really big following in Oslo and Norway. Why don't you do... And then as you plan your gigs, you'll go, I know I'll sell out there. You know, Spotify becomes an enabler in that sense. And I think like it's really interesting. The models are coming out. Like Google might actually start changing... This streaming service might actually change gaming completely, right?
What will they then do for gaming? Yeah. What will they do for gaming in the sense of it's another platform that developers got to build for?
Well, it's a bit like... Not necessarily. It's a bit like... if streaming becomes the way that gaming goes, right? So Microsoft then... people are going to go... When they get addicted to the streaming piece, they go, do I really need to spend £600 or £700 on a big box?
Yeah.
That is a bit of a, you know, an eyesore, and I have to update it every so often. Whereas, you know, Google can just keep improving, or whoever becomes a streaming or whatever streaming services. I'm sure the other gaming houses are looking at a similar opportunity, but they don't. Everything's done in the back end, so it's just you paying £12 a month or whatever it is for an unlimited amount of games. So that means that it's almost like, you know, you code once and it runs everywhere. It's a bit like Java, you know, back in the day.
Yeah.
You wrote your code, you build it once, it runs everywhere instead of building for every single platform. So it's kind of like one gaming house, I built the streaming thing. I can go on this platform. I don't think Google will be the only platform. There'll be others as well.
You've got to expect the same thing, right? There's a Spotify, there's a Deezer, there's a Pandora. Yeah. You've got to expect that this is what we're going to see in the gaming space. And I mean, to your point, Kieran, if that number, and I've read that number, is $140 billion a year.
As an industry and growing.
And that number includes the boxes that you buy, right? Yeah. It includes the 40 or 50 pound games that you buy. It includes the subs. It includes all that. That's the universe of $140. What game streaming has the potential to do in the same way as music streaming is to move that $140 into completely different places.
Yeah.
Because whatever that price of entry is, you know, the price of your stereo or the price of whatever your chosen equipment was, that was your price of entry to the music marketplace as a consumer.
Yeah.
Your price of entry as a gamer now is, if you're a casual gamer, it's your phone, you're going to buy one anyway. If you're a quote unquote hardcore gamer or proper gamer, it's a big PC rig or it's a console. So you're talking £400-£600 price of entry to be a gamer. If that disappears, you've got to assume that doesn't come out of the market. That just goes to a different place in the market. That's where, you know, what's going to be the gaming equivalent of touring to take that revenue? You know, where's the model going to evolve?
Well, you could argue that the addressable market just gets bigger now, right?
It definitely does.
So the housewife that plays Candy Crush, or someone like me who plays games occasionally, would go, you know, I will play Assassin's Creed on my YouTube or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm going, this is great. I don't have to worry about the box. I don't have to do all that shite and worry about it. Just switch it on. There it is. Start playing with the console. Whatever I want.
Lindsay, you mentioned the four big events that happened in gaming that we discussed previously. I think the fifth one that you haven't talked about was my PlayStation being taken away when I had my first child. So when you're, you know, me as a sample of one.
That's devastating, Will. Yeah, that's devastating.
But me as a sample of one, in terms of how that market can potentially grow, I get to play PlayStation with friends very occasionally. Does that make me a much more addressable consumer? Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%.
But you'll just be banned from the internet.
I'll be banned in other ways. You know, it's a very fluid fine system.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, when the missus is down in the shop, you give me straight on flick. Oh, hello, darling. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was just checking the weather.
But you're right. I mean, look, we're flippant, but you're right. It becomes a much more the barrier to entry disappears. There is no PC to buy. There's no console to buy. There's no disc to buy.
Yeah.
It just becomes there. Now, that presupposes that the technology that sits behind it is of a standard to meet the people who are prepared to pay a higher price of entry. But you've got to consider that if it's not now, that's only a function of time.
Exactly. And
I'm not enough of a gamer to understand whether 4K is important or what the frame rate needs to be. Or they talk about latency. I mean, I understand like ad serving latency. I don't really get gaming latency. But you've got to assume that that's just a function of processing power and...
This will fundamentally change the industry. And again, I'd rather over somebody else, but, you know, here we are, Google.
Well, I mean, I don't know if... let's, yeah.
Did they really need any more money?
Well, no. let's get on to that. They've just had to offload, well, they're about to offload 1.49 billion euros worth of money.
Yeah.
Because they've been fined by the EU. It's their third fine, actually the smallest of the three fines.
Yeah.
So the other two were in the sort of region of 4.3 and 2.4 billion euros.
Yeah.
And Will, we were chatting before this, and as you rightfully said, this actually isn't a fine about ad tech. Again, none of their fines have really been ad tech related yet.
Yeah, before we even sort of get into the specifics, that was a tough word, the specifics of this fine, you're right. The EU has addressed their shopping search policy. Yeah. They've addressed Android, iOS. This is an AdSense fine, isn't it?
Yeah.
They haven't really looked at ad tech yet. And I know that there are some strong opinions in the room already about their ad tech footprint.
I don't know what you're referring to. Not the Irish man in the corner.
I won't tee that up yet. But, you know, what their ad tech footprint looks like today and what that may or may not mean for competition. And, I mean, this fine is 10 years in the making. Right,
yeah.
I think best part of 10 years in the making. Complaint made by Microsoft.
Yeah, I will read Margaret Vestager's quote, which is, Google has cemented its dominance in the online search adverts and shielded itself from competitive pressure by imposing anti-competitive contractual restrictions on third-party websites. This is illegal under EU antitrust rules. The misconduct lasted over 10 years and denied other companies the possibility to compete on the merits and to innovate, and consumers the benefits of competition. So, I mean, Margaret Vestager's been gunning for Google every day. I think she wakes up, she dreams of Google, wakes up thinking about Google.
I love that woman.
Is it love or is it hate? So I don't know anymore.
I love that woman. Look,
is that a
from someone
exclusive?
Who's been on the tail end of that AdSense suspension, where I had my account suspended all those years ago because I was putting other ads on the page by Google. I think it's well overdue. AdSense, you know, some of the stuff they were doing in AdSense was crazy. Like, she's fined that company $8 billion now, or $10 billion, or whatever it is. £8 billion,
it's
$10 billion.
Half, yeah.
That's more. That's twice as much tax they've paid in Europe ever, in fines, right? So they've paid two times more fines than they've paid in tax ever in the history of their sort of duration, mm-hmm. of working in Europe, right? Which there's your biggest, one of the biggest issues as to why this will continue. Google and GAFA, right, do not contribute to the tax base of Europe, right? And governments should be rightly concerned about the power they're having over the industry. Like, so look, there is many arguments on both sides, right? We have four companies that completely control the digital ecosystem outside of China, right? And that is just not good enough, right? Now it's getting to the point, like, there's another case right now. I was rang up by a former colleague about a story he's running, I think, tomorrow or the next day, about Google's ITP policy. So there's a massive row going on in Google right now between three warring factions. There's one who are the Chrome team who want to basically slap on the ITP stuff, right, which block all the third-party cookies, right?
Yep.
Fundamentally, right? There is the other team who are the Google marketing team that's kind of over displaying all the... I don't know what Google's sort of system is, but the display team who want basically their first party to be opted in at the expense of ad tech's third party ecosystem, right? So literally everybody else is thrown on the bus, Google gets preference. And then there's the third faction is the legal team who are shitting themselves because they know that this is completely anti-competitive behavior. Now the problem is Google has got no wriggle room here, right? The gaming stuff I think is fine because it's such a competitive space with PlayStation and Microsoft.
Yep.
But in advertising, they are in the shit right now, right? They can't move right. They can't move left. If they do certain things, it will be seen as anti-competitive. Now, imagine tomorrow morning they do this, right? And literally kills off ad tech. And remember the other thing the other day, they went to first party auction.
First price, yeah.
First price auction, sorry. And basically make an EBDA the go-to sort of S2S header for a unified auction, right? If they just made that Google only, it would kill everybody in ad tech straight off the bat. I think they don't know what to do. And probably, I would say this publicly, I'd say they're very close to saying, you know what, we need to get out of ad tech, or we need to divest of one or two things here, because everything we do right now is under the microscope. And if Margaret Vestager, who's leaving that role this year to become the European president, apparently... Her successor is even more anti-GAFA. I heard all of them are gunning for the gaffer, basically. So these fines will continue. The aggression will continue. They need to divest of certain assets. One, I believe they need to get out of the browser. They cannot be the gatekeeper and own the entire ecosystem as well. It's just not gonna fly with the competition authorities. It just won't work. Our crawl ran across a million sites in Europe about a year ago, right? With our own product. 98% of those sites are running DFP. That's 90%, 98%. How is that not anti-competitive? Like, they'll say, well, we've got a free ad server and we have all this, but they use that as leverage to keep their technology in there. Now, we've been arguing this among ourselves about Google. Imagine Google spun out DoubleClick. How much would it be worth? Like, you know, could be worth twice as much as a Trade Desk. So there's definitely value for shareholders here. It's not a case of like we're trying to screw Google out of money. No, what I'm saying is you have to have some Chinese firewalls between their businesses. You cannot have one company controlling all this. It's not feasible, and it's certainly not helping them as a company. Right? Because they're getting fined billions and billions. Shareholders are going, when's this going to stop? It's never going to stop. It's never going to stop. Until they divest of certain assets, it will never stop. Google will become a cash pit for the European Union for the next 10 years.
But the behemoth that is Google is largely funded by search. And so far, they haven't been fined for any of their DoubleClick activities. They've been fined for their search activities.
Yeah.
Now, so we expect probably the DoubleClick, and I'm using air quotes here because obviously DoubleClick as a thing doesn't really exist anymore. DoubleClick as a expected to be next. So 2020, the fines will be for DoubleClick.
The DoubleClick isn't across us. Google should never have been allowed to buy DoubleClick. You talk to every publisher in town, you talk to agencies, you talk to marketers. They just don't like the control that Google has. They don't hate the company. Nobody hates Google. It's a good company. But they have too much power. And when you have too much power, you cannot help yourself. And also, it's a public company, has to make money. So you have to get it and muzzle it. And it's like a wild animal. You've got to nail it down.
I need to nail you down, I think, in a minute. Yeah, do you think that we're getting to a stage with Google now where they actually kind of probably don't know which way to turn? And they've got, I mean, we talk about breaking up big tech. We talked about it a lot last week, as I mentioned earlier, and trying to control big tech and say, you know, Elizabeth Warren is very, very vocal on wanting to break up the likes of Facebook, Google and Amazon. There's also arguments. There was an opinion piece in the FT recently this week that said, actually, there's a case for keeping big tech together. Do you think that Google would like to divest some of its kind of less profitable and kind of the ones that are causing it real issues, which is the kind of the double legacy DoubleClick business, so it can focus on the actual stuff that's doing good in other industries, like, you know, automotive and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a good point. I think, you know, their scale in our world as participants in this digital and advertising ecosystem is such that they bump up against something whenever they move, right? And we were discussing the fines, and, you know, you can take a point of view on the scale of the fines versus revenue, you know, versus profit. I mean, I think last year their traffic acquisition costs were reported at something like $7 or $8 billion, I think. Now, if you add the fine onto that, it becomes 9 or 10 million, and you know, the net revenue still looks okay.
Yeah,
right?
They'll just put that in their P&L as a forecasted how much we get fined this year.
Yeah, so you can take that point of view, and I see it. I think that these questions depend on your point of view, and there's generally two points of view on this. So when you talk about market position, there is like the B2C and the B2B point of view. As a consumer, what do you think about Google's market position? Well, you may love the fact that when you log into your browser and you log into your phone and you log into your email and you log into everything else, all your passwords, whatever, however technically adept you are, you might love that experience. You may also be aware of, as a consumer now, increasingly aware of privacy concerns and, you know, fines actually, and the public display of these fines actually help to educate the public about some of the things that are going on behind the scenes that we might geek out over. But, you know, my dad, as an example, probably doesn't necessarily have a huge perspective on. If you then zoom out and say, well, actually in the micro of digital, they're huge, they bump around, you know, we're finding them to make public aware of what's going on, and they're going to have to make some decisions about it. If you then zoom out and consider large companies, to your point, Lindsay, if you then zoom out and say, well, actually, you know, if You know, if Google wasn't coming from a position of power in digital, would it be able to address the electric cars and automated transport in the way that it has done? And has that been a good thing? And this is me being devil's advocate. And has that been a good thing for the, you know, the world at large? You know, would most of the entrenched car manufacturing in this, you know, certainly in Europe or across the world, would it have addressed, you know, eco solutions? Would it have addressed electric cars in the way that it had done if there wasn't this red hot behemoth coming up on their shoulder saying, look, if you don't do it, we're going to do it. People are going to drive Apple cars and Google cars. You know, so there is that point. And I think people talk about, particularly in the US, and I was, you know, reading some of the opinions that are starting to be expressed now, because politically it's okay to talk about it in the US, whereas it's been Europe that's driven that conversation. You know, what can these new, younger companies like the Gaffer do to perhaps disrupt some of the more established organisations and established markets that people really don't think are great marketplaces? I mean, you look at healthcare, for example, and pharma in the US. You know, what's the disruption possibility for Amazon as a retailer into that? Could that do some more social good than perhaps the social harm that people claim in some of their core marketplaces? And I think that's the discussion, yeah. Right? So your devil's advocate position is it tough to work in digital with Google around? I imagine most people think that it could be. Do they have the potential to do things from that strong base that are good for other industries? Yeah, probably they could do. And I'm not smart enough to understand what the balance is there. You know, I don't understand to what extent they may need to be pruned at the base in order for the digital markets to feel a little bit freer versus where their overreach might be and where the advantages may be in terms of their development and growth as an organization. And that goes for Google and that goes for Amazon and that goes for all of them, and Apple and those businesses as well. But we do have to address it. And what I would say is that the world that we live in now and the dialogue that we have now, even versus 2 or 3 years ago on this topic, it was a barroom topic for people that were in the industry. Right now, this is a public topic. You know, there's a presidential candidate in the US standing up saying something that I don't think any candidate on the political spectrum would have necessarily been able to say in a presidential race. There are things in the US that you don't look like you're against. You don't look like you're not a free market guy. You don't, you know, these are conversations that people now feel like they can have.
Yeah, in the US, it's no longer a Republican or a Democrat conversation. It's actually a unifier.
It's a unifying conversation.
Right. But we are at a point in history right now where we were in the 1900s, where like three or four companies controlled really vital assets, right?
Mm.
And like it or not, digital is the ecosystem that will define our futures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's four companies that have that kind of power. And, you know, it's not even like an ad tech conversation. It's a societal conversation, right?
Yep.
There is a correlation between the wealth disparity and the growth of these companies, right? If you get Google, Facebook and Amazon and Apple going into industries where probably there should be new startups, right? Instead of having like four billionaire or a handful of billionaires, you should have thousands of millionaires, which then has a network effect of creating more and more startups, right? So what we have right now is concentration of power among four companies, which is wrong, right? It's not capitalism. It's some weird monopolistic sort of control they have. Look at what Brian O'Kelly had to do to build a company that could at least compete with DoubleClick. He had to raise $600-700 million. Well, actually more than that. I can't remember. But around that,
it was
that,
a lot
right?
of money. Yep.
Right? And it took his absolute will. And that man has a lot of flaws, but you could admire him for one thing. He could take Google on head on. He just said, I'm building something akin to DoubleClick. Very few people in our industry could do that. Yeah, and that is tough, right? So it's not a case of we want them to go because we want more money. It's a case of they literally have so much power and scale and network effect that they can disrupt industries where I think there should be better companies, smaller companies disrupting that. There should be 1,000 Googles, not one, you know? I feel we've hit a really, really important threshold. Like you said, the conversation has travel from the fringes into the mainstream, right? So we have Margaret Vestager, the hero of the people, who is basically finding Google left, right and centre. The only woman on the planet taking them on. And now it's a presidential debate. It's an actual, going to be an absolute topic in the 2020 race, right? Because for all of Trump's personal failings, intellectual failings, whatever else he's got, he has a gripe against Bezos because Bezos was on the Washington Post. Regardless of that, he still has a target on Amazon, right? And Amazon is hurting small American towns, Republican towns, right? Likewise, you can argue that, you know, the likes of Google, Facebook are challenging middle class entities as well, like, you know, the Democrat strongholds. So this is a real subject now. And I just don't see how these companies are going to get away with this from that much longer. It's going to happen. I'm not sure how, what it looked like. My feeling is that those companies will get ahead of this and will divest of certain assets so they will be less scrutinized. So, for instance, I think that Amazon will spin out AWS because...
Okay.
And then they'll probably ease their...
What's that business worth on its own?
Oh, Jesus. I'd say it's probably worth about 60, 70 billion. Google might just decide, we don't care about display. As Lindsay said, search is our business. Yeah. You know, we don't, you know, we'll keep search. We'll divest of certain assets. Browser, double click. Maybe YouTube spun out as a separate company. That would be amazing. But then given what's happened with Stadia, they clearly have no intention of doing that. Like,
no.
So,
no, those two projects are entwined.
There is something's going to happen, and they must...
I'm with you on that, Kieran, right? I think that the climate, the public discourse...
it's economic, man. It's people's livelihoods.
Yeah, there's that. And, you know, with due respect to everybody, there are a certain amount of people who have that in their mind and would have that as a consideration as a citizen. But there's a much broader group of people who are now exposed to the privacy conversations, you know, those kind of rolled up economic conversations that are now in the public discourse in a presidential race, for example. The climate in which those businesses operate, maybe because of their scale now, maybe they've broken whatever ground or whatever their cover was. Maybe they've broken cover through scale and they've popped up above the skyline or some other metaphor. But they're there for people to look at now and they're there for people to understand. And I think fundamentally, as a citizen of this world now that we all are, it's beholden on all of us to have more of an understanding of how these businesses work, what it means economically, what it means from a personal privacy point of view, and then for you to be free to take your own personal position on all of those things, and they will no doubt affect those organisations. And I think if we were having this conversation in 5 years' time, I think we're going to be talking about slightly different businesses.
Yeah, I think so.
And I can't tell you what's going to be the first action or what will be the driver, whether it will be Google's dominance of a digital, you know, advertising ecosystem, or whether it would be Amazon's dominance of the postal service, or whether it would be, frankly, Facebook's stranglehold on personal privacy and data that's the tipping point. They're all in the room for it, right?
Well, we shouldn't have four companies controlling all different sectors. The whole point of capitalism, you have thousands of companies doing something really well. I have real problems with Amazon going into every single sector and disrupting it and messing it up. And okay, you can say, it's like you've got to stop them. Like, you've got to say, look, you can only do so much.
But in the US, Amazon only represents 5% of retail. So how big are they really? And also, if you think about it, from an industry perspective, we talk about big tech, and we're finally able to talk about big tech because finally, outside of the industry we work in, people are understanding what they do.
So big tech's a public concept.
Yeah, which never was before. It was a bit of an enigma. But you think about big pharma, big food, big tobacco. There's every industry has these big conglomerate companies that control and dominate, and they are far more regulated than tech is, and even they still haven't got it sorted or fixed.
But Lindsay, look at the abnormal amount of profit and market cap that those four companies have, right? They're controlling the fastest growing parts of our industry. That's what concerns me, right? And I believe the legislators in the US and the UK are not intellectually intellectually equipped to deal with this. You saw the questions that Mark Zuckerberg got at the recent hearings. It was embarrassing to listen to. Thankfully,
we asked some better questions than the US equivalent Senate did.
Oh my God!
They were even worse.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely embarrassing. So those companies have got away with a lack of technical and business literacy around their business models. That's not going to happen anymore. You've seen the US. Elizabeth Warren's won. There's another guy called Beto O'Rourke, right, who's running for president. He was a...
skateboarder.
Yeah, he's also a hacker.
Brilliant.
I mean, he's a guy... That the next generation of politician is so clued into this. I don't think they're going to be able to trade in ignorance for much longer. And that's the good thing here. Vestager is probably the first generation that's come going, I know exactly what you're doing. They're unable to control themselves. And I can't blame them, right? They can't police themselves. Therefore, they need to be policed by Vestager, by the FTC, or I don't know who's in the US who's overseeing a lot of this stuff.
But this is the problem. This is the argument we had last week as well about the fact these are global companies. They can't be policed. All we can really do is find them and say, you mustn't do that again.
Change
They'll say,
the
yes, we'll change our...
Change between Facebook and Google, they own 80% of the UK digital ad market, right? That is a fact, right? So let's just say, why don't we reduce that to 50, right? So that means there'll be another 30 for the rest of us. Right? Because it encourages competition. It gives publishers more money. So, you know... But don't forget
who has the money. Who has the money?
The marketers.
Right. That has to be what the conversation.
Hold on. There should be a law about how much of market share you... Because they can control so much more downstream, right? Because of their relationship and supply... The relationship with agencies, the relationship with marketers, the relationship with publishers, it's all connected.
Of course it's all connected, but the money still comes from the marketers. And whether they're being sold a certain product or something by Google and Facebook that they aren't being sold by independent tech is one thing or another, but the money is still coming from them. And if Google and Facebook are making it easier for them to invest that money directly with them, that's not going to change. And legislation wouldn't necessarily make a difference to that.
I think there's a good point around that, which is to say, you know, if we come back into our more addressable world, you know, when there haven't always been the revenue ramifications for these organizations, perhaps when there have been mistakes or violations or whatever you might call it. And you know, it's an easy one to call out what happens with YouTube and brand safety. And it's that, you know, if I was a premium publisher and I was at the behest of, you know, a whole bunch of verification services that were taking a view of the quality of my content or not, competing in a market where I felt that I was only had a 20% shot versus an 80% shot, and you look at what might happen with a YouTube misplacement issue or a brand safety issue, and there may be a blip in revenue, then it all goes back to where it was. You might look at that and say that was a challenging situation to be in as a newspaper that might have 40% of their content deemed not brand safe for reasons of, I don't know, recent news or, you know, those kinds of bits and pieces. There's some inequality perhaps in that. But if you draw it all the way back into I guess our world and the digital ecosystem and what we're doing, is the thing that encourages me is the rising levels of understanding, the rising levels of tech literacy, and the fact that people now understand that this is the world that we exist in. I'm not saying, Kieran, that it can't be changed, and I'm not saying that there are not things that should happen to change it, but politicians get it more. They're going to be able to address it. As people in the industry, we understand it much better than we did when we were barroom boards a couple of years ago. As consumers of advertising and technology, the public understands it, and maybe this is just the cycle that any industry has to go through. You know, it's, you know, I know we forgive ad tech as a young organization and all of those kind of things, but economically things pan out. Economically things are cyclical. There you go. That's why I'm not the editor. And maybe that's just where we're getting to on the cycle. And do you know what? If we get to a place where the public literacy around this topic is of a point where we can actually have a grown-up discussion, then we've got a much better chance of getting to the place that we need to get to. And I think about that in, you know, a micro level in ad tech. You know, I think about publishers understanding the quality of the partners that they choose to deal with better. You know, I think about marketers having more educated choices about their buy decisions. I think about, you know, maybe if they had more options, that would be better as well, but that's probably something for the long term. That raising level of literacy, technical literacy, market literacy, you know, as either as somebody who is subjected to that industry or someone who participates in that industry, there's got to be a good thing. And yeah, there's just been a period of catch up. There really has just been a period of catch up. And we see it now in our business. You know, we see the need for understanding about what it is that's happening in their business and what it is that their partners are doing as being something that's really come through incredibly strongly, driven by regulation, driven by, you know, there's been some things that people haven't been able to get away with. You know, GDPR has emboldened certain people in the ecosystem and it's challenged other people in the ecosystem. But all this movement towards better understanding, better transparency, disclosure of what's going on has to be a good thing.
Yeah.
Right? It has to be a good thing. And it's rocky right now and it's going to pinch. And no doubt, you know, in the next couple of years, from a regulatory point of view, we're going to see GDPR evolve into e-privacy. We're going to see whatever the EU position they want to take on Google and GAFA from a regulatory and compliance point of view. But forget, that process is good, right? That process is public. That process is educational. And allows people to participate more fully in the ecosystem, in the market. And if that happens, then the opportunity for bad behavior decreases. And whether you are, you know, a publisher looking for buy options, or whether you're a marketer looking, you know, understanding of what the options are, their efficacy and their transparency has to be a good thing for everybody. And if we, you know, the knock-on effect of some of the challenges that we're going through is that kind of, you know, a rising tide raises all boats as far as our understanding of what's going on.
That was a very rousing monologue, Will.
Well, you know.
Bring some potential positivity into the frame. And I mean, let's talk about that. So you mentioned literacy a couple of times, mm-hmm. and it's literacy from a consumer perspective, but also from a publishers and marketers having an understanding of what's out there, what their options are, yeah. and making the best choices. I mean, you guys are doing a lot of work at that at the moment with publishers and the AOP.
Yeah.
Talk to me about what that is and kind of how you're helping publishers understand exactly who they're partnering with.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, the Media Trust has been around for a good amount of time, and I think that for folk listening to this who work with us or have worked with us will think of us as, or would have thought of us as, the malware guys and the security guys, and we've certainly been the go-to place for those services for most of the scale platforms in this market for a good amount of publishing. So the AOP project that we've been working on, I think we announced it in November now, so that's already three or four months on. And what we've been trying to create as a technology provider, I guess, for the AOP is a centralized digital vendor list, really, has been the jumping off point for this project. So we sit behind the AOP organization and look at their membership as though, this is a really crude analogy, but as though their membership was an old Comscore AdNet roll-up, right? So there are, there's 40 some publishers that are represented by the AOP, and they represent this many domains, publishing domains. So we sit behind that, and our scanning system sits behind that. And this year, since deployment, we think that there is about 1,600 domains that render across AOP publishing. So we take that domain list, we roll it up into about 1,000 companies, and those 1,000 companies, via their 1,600 domains, are dropping about 1,200 distinct cookies across that portfolio. So what our platform does is takes that information and builds it into, as I say, into a vendor list. So these are the 1,000 vendors that you would expect to come across as a participant in the UK publishing marketplace. These are the cookies you would expect to see. These are the domains that you would expect to see. And behind that vendor list is obviously kind of like a data repository as well, which is to say these are all the cookies. And what we're working with the AOP now to do with the publishers and also with the vendors that are buying from those guys is to categorize and classify all of those things transparently. So a vendor knows, or a member of the AOP, when they access the platform, knows exactly who it is that is doing what within their environments. which sounds, sometimes when I say it, which sounds like something that you would expect, but hasn't always been something that has been easy for publishers or platforms or participants to understand, because that's a big number. You know, if you're a publisher and you look through and you say, oh, I think I'm dealing with 1,000 vendors, or maybe 1,000's too many. If you're just one publisher, 500 vendors, 600 vendors is not unusual in terms of people that are accessing your environment. Mm. How do you start on that process, right? How do you start? And so the AOP project is that start, to try and standardise the way that publishers can address those relationships.
And you said it yourself, you know, you're often thought of as a malware, historically thought of
yes,
as a malware company.
The malware guys,
like, what's brought you down this road? Kind of what do you get out of this project with the AOP? Kind of why, what relates to the malware side of your business to this?
Well, look, there's two answers to that. I mean, firstly, we are still the malware guys in terms of some of the things that we do, right? It's a good portion of the work that we do, and that's the work that is asked of us by our partners. But if you think about the understanding of the digital ecosystem even 3 or 4 years ago, your risk as a participant in that, from a code point of view, and we think, you know, as an organization, we think about our services around third-party code. If you're a publisher, you own the domain, and you then own the code that executes within that domain. There's probably your own code is probably 80% of a publisher page right now. Sorry, 20% of a publisher page, right? 80% is third-party code. Even a few years ago, the risk from that third-party code was malware, was compromise, was virus, all of those kinds of things. Like, now we live in a world where the risk from that third-party code includes, what does it mean for my site performance? What does latency mean for revenue? What does regulation have to say about this cookie or that cookie? What is it that other organizations, what am I trusting other businesses to do in my environments that I can't really influence? And are they going to comply with my rules? So the first part of the answer is, the process whereby we identify bad code is the same process whereby we identify file size and speed and latency and cookies and domains and all of those things. And the roll-up of that is now of as much importance to our partners as just the non-secure bad code malware piece. So that's the first part. The second part, why the project, why the AOP? Well, we're the tech support for a project that's born of the AOP. So I think that the tipping point was probably when the big buy-side groups distributed their first round of response to GDPR, which was their group data ownership policies. I don't think that it's a secret to anybody that caused some consternation. And the AOP as an organization was a great place for the sell side or the publishing response to that to live. So that's where it started. And what the AOP as an organization have done is brought their constituents together in a room with their buy side constituency and agreed and tried to agree the rules for doing business within this ecosystem. You know, these are the ways that we would like people to behave within this ecosystem, which is the AOP. And the key point to address is the way that organisations behave around data. GDPR was the driving piece, the way that they behave around data. And so having established for the AOP this vendor registry, this data registry, the next phase that we're just starting on, well, we've been doing for a little while, but the AOP are just finalising now, is the physical policy document that they're standing behind, the AOP data protocols. They will go into publisher terms, so they will become part of the agreement on which you transact with a publisher. And what those terms say is that these are, you know, as far as data goes, these are the things that we would expect you to do. These are the things that we would expect to execute as part of the normal run of business. Frequency capping, viewability tracking, those kinds of data behaviours. These are the other kinds of behaviours that we think are a separate commercial conversation, like retargeting, like third-party user profiling, those kinds of things. So the protocols will define that. The protocols will live in the system as well. And what our technology will support is the ability for anybody to go into there for free as part of the AOP service and to understand which vendors are doing what with which cookies, for those cookies to be declared, the purpose to be declared, the outcomes to be declared, so that they know exactly when they see these things on their site what they're doing.
And is so you're talking about the different elements that would be declared. Are there things that would be flagged that would be considered to be, say, nefarious or something? Like, would they say, okay, that isn't looking good, remove it, ban them? Or is it more of a...
So the policy piece lives with the team at the AOP.
Yeah.
And so they're the governance of the platform. Our platform is purely the tech. And so what they will do is go in. We're currently contacting vendors. And what we're asking them is we're saying, hey, we've seen you. Can you please confirm what it is that you're doing, define your cookies, categorize your cookies, be transparent about what you're doing, first part of the process. And I think for the AOP, that's probably the first stage that they want for vendors to complete. The AOP are then able, at a cookie level or at a vendor level, to say whether or not that cookie or that vendor is, and these are not hard terms, authorised or prohibited. Prohibited doesn't mean blocked. Authorised doesn't mean great. What it means is the way, have they done the right thing? Are these vendors doing right. the right thing as it relates to the protocols that we've all agreed? And so from a publisher, that's a big step forward, right? Because that's a block of publishing that represents a good portion of this market that have a standardised view on data behaviours from vendors. And that's not something that we've ever really as an industry been able to get behind. So the reason that we do this for the AOP is because we've been doing this piecemeal for publishers, and it's very hard because you know one policy is here, one policy is there. To enforce different policies piecemeal in this market is a real challenge. For there to be a standardization of policy around data is a big opportunity to move this conversation forward.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and that's really what we're trying to do. So our provision is free for members. Our service provision is absolutely free. So from our point of view, it furthers our mission as a company, which is to tidy up some of this stuff. And generally, our partners will contract us to tidy this stuff up. This is an opportunity to move behind one unified policy across a big piece of the publishing ecosystem that probably, by the time we've been through all the vendors, represents most of the vendors that you'd expect to deal with.
And because you've got that list of vendors now, obviously you're working with the AOP, which is a UK organisation, mm-hmm. largely driven by regulation and particularly GDPR within the EU. Can you see this being rolled out to other markets with other organisations and potentially beyond the EU as well?
Yeah, so those conversations are happening. And, you know, this is the AOP UK cookie consortium. We would hope very much that other organisations, regional, worldwide organisations, would look at this and see the opportunity.
Is that your sweet spot then, going in and doing a sort of talking to the governing body, the publishers?
For a project like this, then absolutely, because there needs to be a mobilising point for this. And you can see the market dynamics of this in lots of different places. You can see it in Ozone. You can see it in Laplace. You know, we're not trying to be that thing. But the market dynamics that create those consortiums are the same market dynamics that we can help to support with this, which is to say there are commercial reasons and technology-driven reasons why Laplace and Ozone and those guys are being driven. From a regulation point of view, this has to live in the AOP, or it has to live in one of the other, you know, local or regional organisations, because they have to be a neutral arbiter of what is okay between their constituents and between their customers. We're the technology layer that detects and supports and looks to enforce is too strong a word, but looks to support.
So
that
I have a question for you then. I know people are going to listen to this and think that you're the Bob Geldof of ad tech.
Is that what I am? Can I have that? Is the domain free?
Yeah, you can have that, Bob Geldof of ad tech. But I'm just wondering, like, as a commercial entity, what is sort of like, what products did you add on to that? Because you were talking about, you know, the ability to have like workflow tools and stuff like that. What sort of, obviously this is a sort of a free service with the AOP, but
yeah.
How do you fund your expensive lifestyle?
How do we fund my expensive lifestyle? So, as I said, the Media Trust as an organisation, most folks may well know about the work that we do in security and malware. You know, our provision now is into ad tech, and it is into publishing as it has always been, in a much broader sense of risk management than just malware.
Right.
It is about understanding what third-party code renders in your ecosystem, as a DSP, as an exchange, as a supply side partner, as a publisher, and our services help you to manage your policy around those things.
Right.
Right. The AOP and the other group projects that we have done exist as group projects. So as a member of the AOP, you can go in and see this cookie dictionary, this data repository. You will need need technology to relate that dictionary definition back to your own site. You can use the Media Trust for that. So a number of our customers are already AOP members, or maybe AOP members are already our customers, whatever that might be. So for those guys, it's relatively straightforward. Their account is enabled with a different set of regulation views, which is called the AOP regulation view. And we can match their ecosystem back to that policy, or other solutions may be available. But, you know, it is an opportunity for us to be sort of more present, for sure. But we also think that it's work worth doing.
Do you think there's an opportunity for you to connect, like, the ops people at the publisher with the ops people at the ad tech vendor, and being able to sort of like go, hello guys, we've seen this code, what's this about?
I haven't briefed you, Kieran, but it's almost like I have. So
I really haven't been briefed at all. That question has come out of my
He's
head.
He's been allowed to speak again after running so much.
Yeah, our system has
angry.
I guess our products and our system is in two parts, right? There is the technology at the center of our system that serves for detection and you know, which cookies which, whatever, the technical engine, the scanner, the blocker, all that kind of stuff. There is also we also have a product that we call the Vendor Network, which is a soft system that sits over the top of that. You know, one crude analogy might be to call it sort of like LinkedIn for ad tech, whereby our customers and other people who are not our customers but are members of the digital ecosystem have an account, have a node, whereby they can communicate with each other.
This is your DVRM tool.
This is DVRM, yeah. So we have a digital vendor network and digital vendor risk management, yeah. I guess, is the concept of what you would do within that system. So to your point, Kieran, I am publisher A. I receive a malware notification that says this buyer in this system via this exchange has delivered this code, as an example.
Mm.
Now, one of the challenges for organizations historically with that information is, and what do I do with that, right? And if you are a large publisher with a large contract at an SSP, then you probably just tell them to sort it out, or there will be ramifications, right? And maybe and that's what happens. You know, your access to that kind of a service slips a little bit with your scale. So what do smaller publishers do when the offense is in a smaller part of the ecosystem? How do I even know who to contact at DSP number two? How do I remediate this? You know, what do I do with those kind of things? So our vendor network sits over the top of that and allows for you to manage that communication as well. So you can share your policies, acknowledge your policies, acknowledge breach. We can also use our system to distribute those notifications as well. So hi publisher, this is the violation that we've seen. We'll also distribute that to the supply side partner, to the bidder, so that they can then see the issues that we've flagged, and so that they can remediate those things as well. And as a business, having grown from helping people with security into helping people with broader digital risk, what we see now is the way that what is incumbent on everybody is not just to put your fingers in the leaky dam wherever that leak may affect you, whether there is a malware leak here or a data leak here or a, you know. What we're trying to drive forward is, with all of our partners, wherever they exist in the ecosystem, is an understanding fundamentally of who do I do business with, right? As a publisher, I've probably got three SSP contracts in my drawer. Is that who you do business with? That's not who you do business with. You do business with every single buyer on every single DSP that's connected to every single exchange that walks into those, that walks into that platform that then connects to your site. So if we talk again about what, you know, how many vendors will execute across a publisher, it's the roll up of that. And if you want to fundamentally as a participator in this ecosystem, if you want to address what your risk profile looks like, then it is the first place to do it is understanding what that is.
Mm.
You know, so rather than just keep putting your finger in the dam every time, you know, block an ad because it's bad, or, you know, get a notification because I've got an issue here, ask yourselves the question, who am I doing business with? Who should I be doing business with? And the vendor network allows for that transparency. We don't compel people to participate. But obviously what we're trying to do through that system and what we're trying to do with that broader concept of understanding who you do business with is make it harder for the people who are bad participants in this ecosystem to hide. You know, yeah. if you don't declare to the AOP what your cookies are doing, we don't prohibit you from working with, well, we don't do anything, we're just a platform. You don't get prohibited from working, but that is a position that you've taken. My cookies are in your ecosystem, I'm not going to tell you what they're doing. You know, what does that tell you about an organization versus another organization that says, yep, they're there, this is what they do, I'm completely transparent about what they look like, here's the definitions, here's the sets, are you okay with that? As a participant, you should view that as a statement of transparency and trust between you and a partner, potential partner, rather than perhaps the greyer scenario that exists elsewhere.
It's all part of a wider effort to weed out the bad actors and actually get the publishers to understand who it is they're working with and who their partners are.
Yeah, we talk about creating like a transparent and well-lit space for advertising with our partners.
Yeah, makes a lot
which
of sense.
Is that people who are well-intended and want to do the right thing will. Those that don't, won't. And if nothing else, that's a map for you to decide where your business should exist within.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
And when I'm choosing which bidders I should accept on my exchange, or I'm choosing which supply side partners I should work with, or when I'm choosing these things, that should be fundamentally part of your decision making process.
Indeed.
And in an inherited situation, that should also help you to understand who you continue to do business with. Who do you prioritise? Who do you want? Who's there?
Absolutely. And Will, I'm sorry, I have to cut you off there because it's been a very long episode. I want to thank you for joining us. We're very, very late.
Oh gosh. Okay.
Thank you, listeners. I hope you enjoy this super long episode. Kieran, let's blame you for being so long.
Look, I like Google, right?
This
episode might say I like Google. I just want you to leave ad tech.
Let's hope that people get to the end of this episode to have heard you say that, to backtrack on everything you just said. Yeah. And Will, want to say thank you very much for joining us.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everyone. This has been the Mad Tech Podcast.